All right, thanks, Richard. Yep, and now for something maybe a little bit different, still in the realm of ecology and microbes and viruses. This talk will be on space-time frontiers of marine viral ecology. I'll try to at least get a little bit of that first part of that title in. Just want to make sure to credit those who've done the work, some folks who were previously in the lab, Luis Colbert, Bradford Taylor, Chad Wington is just about to graduate, and current postdoc Stephen Beckett, and current PhD student Ashley Conan from physics. And so the title Space-Time Frontiers, you know, this audience, I would say, evokes this, right? This notion of looking at billion-year-old remnants of colliding black holes, and there were some folks at Georgia Tech involved. There's probably someone involved from every one of your institutions, and there's about 100 plus, I don't know how many hundreds of institutions involved in that discovery. Within, let's say, the marine microbial world, specific oceanography world, they also think about space and time, and they often block it up like this, in terms of spatial scales, all the way down to millimeters, up to global scales in time on the order of seconds, or even less, up to hundreds of years, and obviously with climate change, even longer. Right? And so there's this notion here that there's a cascade of interactions that spans from very small, microscale, up to these large-scale effects. And when one thinks then about what viruses have to do with any of this, usually in these conceptions, this is largely kind of a physical oceanographic view. There's also a biological oceanographic view. And so I like to think of this cascade of scales as being something that's worth trying to understand in the context of marine virus interactions and their consequences. And on Tuesday, I talked about this a little bit, as did Paul, that virus-host interactions modify obviously the fate of individual cells. So at the level micron-sized scale interacting with this 15-nanometer or so virus particle, there's something going to happen to it, the death of the cell, and the release of new virus particles. Other fates are obviously possible. Because of that individual-level interaction, we can look at population scales and see there could be consequences in terms of oscillations that aren't necessarily due to exogenous inputs, but rather endogenous and non-linear feedbacks that give rise to these population-level oscillations. And increasingly, people have speculated, and with often direct evidence, that viruses have large-scale global biogeochemical effects. And so this wasn't really always the case. I mean, this notion, and maybe not all of you are familiar with it, and I'll try to give you an overview today. That's really my intent, is to kind of get people a background, maybe get some of you excited about looking more into this area, that there's this notion that viruses are important as global ecosystem players, not just as agents of mortality and disease. And again, it wasn't always this way. There's about a 100-year-old field in the sense of that 100 years ago, 102, depending on who you attribute it to, the discovery of phage by Tort and then Durrell. And so this was immediately, as we talked about on Tuesday, conceptualized as a potential therapeutic, but quickly after, rather, for the most part, discarded as a potentially ecologically relevant discovery, because people found at the time very little evidence that these phage, bacteriophage, were in seawater, soils, etc., in the environment. And in the 40s, a prominent microbiologist, Zobel, found, again, scant evidence that there were any relevant densities of bacteriophage out in natural environments in seawater. In the late 70s, people began to have a different view by looking at TMs and other ways of identifying through culture-independent means that there were viruses at densities of about 10 to the 4th per mil. And then something happened in 1989. And if you look at citations or look at viral ecology, bacteriophage ecology, it really kicks off at this point. So I want to explain what was it that happened in 1989, and what are some of the new discoveries, and what are some of the challenges, in my view, at the moment. So in 1989, this is more or less what happened. This is a Berg et al. Paper, Nature 1 micron scale. And they had taken samples from freshwater and some marine environments and looked at them with a DNA stain. And you'll see some arrows there. And those arrows point to little circles, and those circles are about 50 nanometers in diameter. And what they said is these are virus-like particles. They're small, compact objects, about 50 nanometers in size, that seem to contain DNA. And by counting backwards out from how much of the sample they took in these views, they estimate 250 million virus particles per milliliter, which is 1,000 to 10 million times higher than previous reports. And so you might ask, well, how did these people find this many more? Did they look at somewhere special? I'll show you later in this talk that they didn't look anywhere special. They just looked in a different way, or thought to look in a different way. And part of the reason they thought to look in a different way is that they didn't rely on first cultivating a bacteria and then using those cultivated bacteria as a way, as a bait, to fish out the viruses. Because for one, first of all, you might not have chosen the right bait. And so you may be looking at a rather, let's say, rare member of your microbial community. And in addition, even if you chose a ubiquitous member, it's not necessarily the right environment for you to bring out the viruses. So for all these reasons, largely due to culture bias, there's this vast undercounting of natural densities of viruses. And with this densities, it raises lots of questions. What are they doing? Where are they coming from? Right, so this is something that, again, I think is really seminal in terms of moving this field forward.
How did they know this was virus?
They say it's virus-like particles at the time. Later on, people there's still an ongoing debate. So the complete answer is that these sort of stain-based approaches could be conflated with vesicles, though there's been estimates of the vesicle densities now. They could be other things in the environment, but they attribute them to virus-like particles, and other ways of now looking through modern methods and metagenomics have maintain that these are predominantly viruses, not just virus-like particles of that shape and size. That's a longer chat. But at the time, they did use the word VLPs, virus-like particles. Yeah. So in 2002, I'd say that's the next stage. So you have a lot of stuff. But what is this stuff? And you can't culture it. You can't bring it into the laboratory. And so the work of Forrest Rauer, Maya Breitbart, and a number of others, this is a Breitbart et al. Paper at PNAS, is they started to look at the genomic content of those virus-like particles, those virions, the viruses that are outside of cells. And they looked at two different uncultured communities, and for the most part, everything they found, and you could almost put this same slide up today, though the shrink, maybe it shrunk a little bit, was unknown. So no idea what this stuff is. It's unrelated to previous reported sequences, which suggests not only there are a lot of viruses, there's a lot of diversity, and most of that diversity is unknown at present to science. So that was another innovation forward, that these weren't just all the same kind of virus, we'd just been missing it, there were many kinds of viruses out there, we didn't know what they were. The other, I'd say, exciting advance that's happened in the 2000s and 2000s, vague, all these are still pushing on to today, is this notion that viruses, as they get into cells, are not just, as I said, agents of mortality for the cell, but are modifying what is going on in the cell. And the big story there came from the cyanophage, which are viruses that infect cyanobacteria, these ubiquitous autotrophs, which are responsible for about 25% of the oxygen that we breathe every day, are produced in the oceans by these, let's say, surface-living cyanobacteria, which themselves are infected and lysed by cyanophage. And in the process, there's this really whole-scale reorganization of metabolism. And so this was a, you know, this photosynthesis story, and the fact that there were virus lineages, really, of these photosynthetic genes was a major story by Mann, by Clokey, Matt Sullivan, Breitbart, others within Penny Chisholm's lab. And I just looked this morning, and I saw Patrick Forterre tweeted out the following, smart viruses encoding ribosomal proteins, not ribosomes. And this had been something else that people had wondered for a long time. Do viruses actually modify even the ribosome? And until this morning, I never heard anything about this, but this just came out. So you can read the paper. Apparently, viruses are actually encoding ribosomal proteins and one presumably of modifying the core machinery of cells. Right? So this seems like a pretty exciting bit of news. It's on BioArchive. You can retweet it or read it. There's a lot of one instead of the other. Right, so in terms of the global picture, all of these things fold into, I'd say, a more nuanced view. And really, if I don't get all the way through, I'd say this is one of the most important slides I want to present today, which is, yes, viruses infect and lyse cells. In the process, they're modifying metabolism. The lysis, therefore, releases new material back into the environment, which can then have an indirect effect on the behavior of autotrophs, which then recycle inorganic material. So it contributes to, one could imagine, the retentiveness of the microbial loop in the surface oceans. On the other hand, there's been some other questions about whether or not are they generating stuff that's sticky and could aggregate and therefore even sink out. So there's a, I'd say, a pretty interesting debate going on right now. There's, let's say, a general view that viruses are important in terms of redirecting material, whether or not the fate of that material increases retentiveness or actually may be partly responsible for driving organic carbon deeper into the ocean remains unresolved. This notion, though, of viruses as ecosystem players is really the key message that I want to leave you with and hopefully give more examples today. Okay, so what I'm going to try to do is say a little about what we know, and I think what we can learn about marine virus effects on community ecosystem processes, and I'm going to use more marine examples than I might otherwise would in a different context. And I'll try to divide this up in terms of time and space. If I have time, I'll try to get through both, but I'll try to give examples of both. And so I'll begin with time, first bring up what we know and what I think that we can learn by using theory in combination with some of these new omics methods. And I'll try to then review what we know and what I talked about on Tuesday just in this one slide, which is for a long time there's this notion that viruses are predators and therefore there should we should think of predator-prey-like dynamics as our organizing concept for understanding virus effects. As I said on Tuesday, there's this microscopic dimension. These are obligate intracellular parasites. They get in, they come out after some period of time, this latent period. As a consequence, you see these, or predict both from theory and observe, these endogenous oscillations, right, in which there's this phase shift where the virus peak seems to follow the host peak. And as I also mentioned on Tuesday, this can sometimes be reversed or even lost altogether when evolution arises, there's evolution resistance, and then you have these cryptic oscillations. So there's some interesting stuff. There's all sorts of neat things we can think about in terms of eco-evolutionary dynamics. What can we learn from these signals? But I want to go in a slightly different direction because here's one virus, one host. Here implicitly there are two hosts, one virus. This is a very slow pace, right? 2-2, 3-2, in trying to build up all these combinatorics. And the problem is that in natural environments, here's one example on the left, the marine sediment sample contained between 10,000 and 1 million viral genotypes. Right? Now these are based on rarefaction estimates, so you do these collector curves, you look again and again, do I see the new thing when I keep sampling? And then the rate at which you see new things give you some asymptotic estimates. So first of all, what I think you should take away from this is that virus communities are truly quite diverse. This wasn't just an unusual discovery in 2002. The other thing you should take away, these estimates are really problematic. That's two orders of magnitude estimate. And we've gone into some of this. I think there's really a problem with these species richness estimators because they rely on the rare parts to give you estimates of the total diversity. But the rare parts are precisely the things that you can't observe. So you have to say something about tails, but you're looking at the commons, so you just really have a lot of uncertainty, and it propagates into these predictions. It's not just in terms of the diversity of the viruses themselves, but also the sequence space, the different genes or proteins that they encode. There were some early estimates that approached billions, and now it seems that we're talking about millions of different viral genes. So yes, viruses encode a lot of diversity, but there's also strong selection to purge it. And so I don't think there's a general consensus that viruses are the sort of library of every possible gene on the planet. A lot of this is getting out quickly. So there's estimates now that have come down. Still, a lot of genetic diversity sitting on top of this, let's say, phylogenetic diversity. Okay, so we have all this diversity, and we want to figure out a little bit more about who's interacting with whom, and therefore how they're coexisting in time. And so the way traditionally people have done this is in a culture-based way, collect bacteria and viruses from the environment, you culture them, you take your culture collection of virus, culture collection of bacteria, and you do the crosses. Right? So you can do something like this, where you have this top agar, and you're looking for spots or plaques on these top agars, and the absence of these plaques denote the fact that that virus, you tried to get it to infect that bacteria, but it didn't work. So the zero actually means that there was an effort, but it was unable to infect. So it's not a lack of evidence, it's the evidence of absence of the ability of that particular virus to infect a particular bacteria. One can do this many times, and many people have done this over the years. This is one example where the viruses, the phage are in the columns, the hosts are on the rows, and the white spots denote that there was evidence of that virus able to infect that particular bacteria, and the blue background means unable to infect. So what we did in thinking about, okay, what can we say if we know something about these small microcosms or in vitro experiments and how interactions lead to different kinds of dynamic signals, could we say anything about these more complicated communities? To do so, we wanted to see if there was any tendency or pattern of interactions or infections at this community scale. And just give me an example that we digitized this stuff, and then we did that again and again for about 38 different studies, which had over 12,000 different infections, which vary tremendously in terms of the taxa group, where they were sampled from, and so on. And so when you look here, initially, there's not like a pattern, even though I know it's a little bit small, there's not an evident pattern that jumps out that these interaction networks have one characteristic structure. right? It just doesn't immediately pop out. It certainly didn't pop out to us. But there's really no need for it to pop out because you have a large combinatorial space of ways to look at this, right? So you have 20 rows, 20 columns. The same data could be looked at 20 factorial squared different ways, right? So you need some heuristic approaches to try to identify if these have any underlying structures. So what we did is use some standard network approaches also based on theories in the field that viruses may, along with their hosts, tend to expand in host range, and the hosts would, in parallel, therefore, increase their resistance to prior viruses, leading to this sort of nested structure. So this is an example of the original data. This is the same data, but now you see very evidently you have a spectrum of specialists and generalists, permissive hosts, and hosts that are very hard to infect or not at all able to infect by these particular sets of viruses. And again, it's the same data. What's interesting is that the specialists, for the most part, and this was the tendency within all the data that we looked at, tend to specialize on the permissive host. So they're infecting the host that everyone else is, including the generalists. And that leads to some questions that I'll try to address in a moment. So this is what we call nestedness, the notion that the host range and virus range, respectively, are nested one within the other. And so, again, this suggests that I don't think you've probably heard that viruses are really specialists. They have very narrow niches. Just to step back for a moment, there are viruses that can infect, certainly at the genus level, so cyanophage can infect cyanobacteria that are both Prochlorococcus and Staphylococcus, and if you're a microbial oceanographer, you know those things are very different, but there are viruses that can span that, even up to family level and so on. My point here is that we really have a spectrum of specialists to generalists. There are different life history strategies here, and likewise, spectrum from hard to infect to susceptible. Yes?
So I'm wondering why you infer that this is a strategy. I mean, the pattern you saw in the previous thing could be there are some crappy viruses and resistant viruses and some resistant cells and very unresistant cells, right? And
You found the one word that's a good way, it's a good poke on that word, because I'm about to show you how there are potentially trade-offs in these things, and so there is some sense that I want to think about that word as a strategy which comes with costs and benefits, rather than necessarily a spectrum that the more generalist is always better, and the one that's, and one is crappy. So I think with these other life history traits, that's what I mean by a strategy. And if there are constraints, then there really is a spectrum of choices here. And it's not evident that, as I'll explain in a moment, that being the specialist is the good thing, or being the generalist is the good thing, if there are costs associated with that generalization and specialization. But you're right, I haven't proven to you that these are the only things that they could do. Let me keep going and add some more context. Yep, of course.
Struggling with the definition of nestedness.
Yep.
So arithmetically, it sort of looked like the statement that you can permute the rows and the columns and get the structure to be sort of some generalized upper triangular piece.
Right, there's different ways, one of which actually involves the simplest way heuristically to do it, just order them by their degree. And it turns out that that's a pretty good ordering. There are other ways to do it, which doesn't involve me actually laying it out in this way. You compare the overlap across all combinations of rows, and you're asking, are those overlaps, do one tend to be nested in the other, or do they have exclusive sets? So you're looking at the set size, and you do that for all combinations, and you normalize it. I'm doing it, I use this visualization way for you to see, if I drew a line, there's another definition which I draw some isocline, imagining I maximally fill and see what the deviation is. They more or less give you the same thing. So there's two different metrics that we use to quantify nestedness, which are fairly standard. And those are the essential ways. One which is combination, and one which makes an isocline and looks at the mistakes on either side. So this broadening appears common in both ecological and evolutionary studies, and it also raises this question, which is where we were going for in the first place, and I'll try to make it clear here, that these niches are overlapping. It's not as if one virus gets to take over that space and one virus gets to take, no, they're actually sharing in some fundamental sense the host that they're infecting. And this raises the question, why doesn't this most resistant host outcompete the rest? Right? It's infected by one virus, virus 5, but so is everyone else, and they're affected by more. And likewise, why isn't this most specialist virus outcompeted by everyone? It's infecting host 5, but so is everyone else, and the other viruses infect other hosts. Okay. So in order to begin to at least think about this, we did the same thing similar to what I did on Tuesday, which is think about a nonlinear feedback model similar to these Locke Volterra models, except now you have different strains. So here's hosts and viruses. There's some sort of host growth and competition. I've set competition to be neutral here to focus on the virus effects. Viruses infect hosts with this matrix M. Viruses are released and they decay. And this is similar to what is called kill the winner model. So there's this notion of negative density-dependent feedback that means that when a host gets too abundant, the virus infects it knocks it back down, and this happens all the time, and therefore no one dominates. But that assumes this kind of network, that you have this specific type associated with each host. So it's quite similar to that, except we replace that one-to-one network with this nested network, which we observe repeatedly in these data sets. And then put this in here and ask, what are the conditions necessary amongst all the other traits, because host range is not the other trait here, that would enable coexistence. And what we find is exemplified here. These are two small toy networks, 2x2. They're both nested, so 3 of the 4 interactions are present. And in one simulation, all 4 coexist. And in one simulation, 2, meaning a pair, a virus and host pair, are dropped out. So it's the same network. And it doesn't matter about initial conditions. This is an initial condition, numerical integration error. The difference is that there's life history traits. And they differ. So we've changed the traits in a certain way. And in one case, if there's a trade-off between defense and growth, and likewise between virulence and host range, that enables the coexistence despite the fact that they don't have exclusive niches. So this can go arbitrarily large. So you can get larger and larger numbers of these viruses and hosts. I should be careful, arbitrary, but larger. We've explored some of it, which extent they can grow and start even bootstrap, so start from a small number of types and actually diversify into many types. And so here's an example of 5x5 with this nested network. As long as there's the trade-off, that we observe this coexistence. So this raises the question, is there any evidence for such trade-offs? So I'm going to give some, and I'm going to point out the fact that it's some because I think that's important. Here on the left is one with different Procolococcus strains, each of which has resistance to a particular kind of protovirus. And this is the relative growth rate. Here's the wild type. And you have multiple examples in which this resistance seems to have a cost in terms of growth rate. But you'll notice there are other examples in which there seems to be no cost. This host is able to become resistant, evolve resistance to this particular virus without any associated cost in growth rate. So, to the extent that I've looked at this literature, my view is that it's a tendency, it's a statistical tendency, but it's not universally so. In fact, people have raised the question, including Debbie Lindell, that the issue may be that resistance to one type enables exposure to another. So it's actually more like whack-a-mole rather than this strict trade-off here in terms of growth rate and resistance, though the tendency is there. And likewise, Paul, you may remember this work from some time ago, maybe, by Siobhan Duffy and Christina Birch. In which this is a viral trade-off where there was a niche expansion. This is RNA bacteriophage 5-6. No, that's not marine. That's in the same system you talked about on Tuesday. So it's able now to expand and infect a new host. But as a consequence, a number of these strains now have a fitness cost, so they now are less fit on the original host. But again, you see there are examples in which there seems to be no cost, and there's not this pleiotropic effect. So my understanding here on this side, too, is that there's this tendency, but it's not universal. So I don't have time to talk about it today, but we've also modified some of these models and also shown that if there's a tendency for this trade-off with nestedness, there are regimes and parameter space that facilitate coexistence. There's an intertangling between these life history traits, the network, and the diversity question. We can talk about that later.
And if it were not nested and you played the trade-offs, you wouldn't find the regime?
Yeah. Let me give you an example of what a not nested network would be, and there's a backup slide I can show you later. Which answers that question. But let me just give you this other example. So I've given you the strong impression that in natural environments, there's this inevitable nestedness that arises, and that certainly seems to be the case, but there's a bias there. There's a culture bias. These are all culture-based studies, and that's hopefully what we get to next. There's another bias, which is you're working, some of you are in this course, and you're not working on both E. coli and cyanobacteria at the same time and studying cross-infectivity of viruses that are infecting those two groups. And so if you had, you'd imagine that probably the cyanoviruses can infect the E. coli bacteria, and that's clearly not a nested structure. It's probably something that's more modular. So what we did is found a group back in the early 80s. It's this crazy study, Carl Mobus, who had, as far as I understood, every day just went and collected more bacteria, isolated them, collected more viruses, isolated them, and see who infected whom, and published this paper in the early 80s, which has a foldout that's like this big. And this is experimental work for theorists. We digitized this very big foldout. Actually, it took a few months. There's reasons for that. You know, paper degraded and so on. But this is the original foldout. And it's collected in the Atlantic Ocean. So they're going across on a cruise collecting bacterial viruses from different locations and then going back and doing all the permutations. So they ended up doing about 286 hosts, that's right, and 215 viruses. This is what they published and noted that there was a lot of heterogeneity. So I want to point, this is the same data. It's the same data. But now everything, about 95% or more, is organized into these modules. And the modules aren't always from the same site. So you have viruses from the future or the past that can infect hosts from the future, thousands of kilometers away, right? Which also raises some interesting questions of the size of metapopulations in marine environments. But for us, it just confirmed this notion that at certain larger scales, we expect to see modularity. Though what's interesting is that inside some of these modules, we again see nestedness. So we have this note there may be different structures at different scales. And to going back to your question, is that if we assume that now there's modularity is the structure, there's a different region of parameter space that can facilitate biodiversity in that structure regime. So it's not as if only one kind of structure begets biodiversity, but there's different parts of parameter space that are entangled with the structure. So these two things are not separate. We can talk about that. So the summary thus far is that trade-offs can facilitate coexistence or constraints in these life history straits. These are related to the network structure. Nestedness is characteristic, but it need not be perfect to facilitate coexistence. And modular networks are certainly present, certainly at larger scales. So these are some of the things that I think we know and even know about marine environments. But what can we learn? And I think that the key thing here is that all of this stuff that I just described, let me just finish the sentence, I'll take a question, is based on culture-based studies. And so this represents a small drop of the diversity in the system, and certainly a small understanding of the potential interactions. So I'm going to try to explain a little bit about what efforts are going to figure out partners, functional partners between viruses and hosts, specifically in marine environments, and how theory might play a role. But you had a question?
Yes, why do you say that nestedness facilitates coexistence?
Insofar as those life history straits are present, then it can give rise to a large number of coexisting types. It is not something unique, and I'm going to try to restate it, that nestedness along with certain conditions of parameter space together can give rise or enable a larger number of types that might otherwise be possible if it was just the structure alone. So it's really more of the entanglement that I want to make the point of,
so
not the structure itself.
If you had the same
correct
trade-offs, you could still get coexistence without nestedness.
If you had those trade-offs with the wrong structure, so it's the structure, the traits and the structure that together, and the mismatch will not necessarily work. That's really the point I'm making. Okay, so what can we learn? And I'm going to try to motivate this part by thinking about this forward problem, which is that I've given you these interaction networks and said, well, if those are the networks in natural environments, what are the conditions which we might observe coexistence and what are the consequences of those networks? But in many cases, we don't know this, and we can increasingly observe this, which is the changes in densities of different types at different strain resolutions, depending on methods, and we'd like to figure out who interacts with whom, and there's a whole body of literature of trying to bring the virus and host together, viral tagging, polonies, digital PCR and so on, and others. Those usually require both a lot of work and also a bait host. So they're targeted. You have a targeted host, you want to know who's infecting that host. And we're interested in this community signal. Okay, so I view this as this inverse problem. And the way that people have often done this is correlation-based. You observe these time series, you look to see what's correlated, and you make the jump that the correlations tell you something about the interactions. And I'm going to try to make the claim that these model-based approaches as an alternative may be preferable, and I'm happy to get feedback. And let me give you one example of what I mean by correlations. This is a study by Needham et al., done out here in the Pacific Ocean off the coast, in which they observed over many months by recurrent sampling different strains, they use these targeted genes as a way to capture from let's say culture-independent methods, the changes in density of particular strains. Here, SAR11 and other Simicococcus, as well as myoviruses, a particular kind of phage. And they're looking at these time signals and then asking, in essence, if I take these and overlay them, which correlate, and based on those correlations, often locally, they generate these interaction networks, which are often quite dense. And now, of course, they don't really know what's going on, but this is, one might argue, a reasonable thing to do in the absence of other information. And so the problem that we've had is that, if some of you have done time series inference before, this has been raised within mouse gut metagenomes, I think most recently by Zhao Xavier, some of you may be familiar with this, where they've been concerned that these correlation networks really don't recapitulate the interaction networks. And so what we wanted to ask was the following. Let's say I start with a quantitative and net, in this example, a nested interaction network. And then I use the models to generate time series of different strains of the bacteria and the viruses. And then I forget the fact that I know that answer. But I just use these, and I think that's the right model that's underlying, the mechanism that's underlying the time series I observe. And then I just do the comparison here of correlations and ask, do the correlation networks recapitulate the known network? And the answer is no. You might say, well, that's not the right thing to do because I've told you before that there's this time shift, so I should shift them in time. And you can shift them however you want in time, and you end up finding you get more and more positive interactions. And even if you threshold them, the essence here, and there's a longer story there, is that correlation not only need not recapitulate these interactions, but we find they tend not to. They tend to have very bad, if you do these sort of receiver-operator curves, way too many false positives and very few, your reliability, the true positive is low. So if you knew, this doesn't close the loop. So the underlying mechanism that correlation implies interaction, if you try this with one of these mechanistic models, doesn't seem to work. Yeah?
But in addition to the metagenomic data, would not take into account polymorphism within species, no?
Right, so the metagenomic data, we're not talking about OTUs at the moment. So if you get at the OTU level, that is too functionally ill-resolved to be of much use. So we are thinking more about strains, and whether or not there's a polymorphism that it would still be silent with respect to a functional difference. So let's say you have two strains that are so closely related that there's just a single SNP and that totally changes profile. That's a question that we're trying to grapple with, right? How do you do this in practice? My point here is that if you look at the correlations, it doesn't seem self-consistent with the notion that those are the same as interactions. Yeah. So I want to explain a slightly different method, and this is really an adaptation of what Zhao Xavier's work has done within mouse metagenomes, mouse gut metagenomes, which is you take these time-varying signals, you sample them, and this leads to not just the individual densities, but the per capita changes in densities over time. So you're looking at per capita changes. And then you use the model as a means to try to figure out the things you don't know. So here are the measured per capita changes in viral densities. And this is just a reframing of that one equation within the Lockerbie-Terra model where you have this cross-infection network and these viral decay rates. Both are unknown, but you know the per capita changes in host densities. So in fact, you know the present host densities and the per capita changes. And now you want to try to figure out what these unknown both matrix and decay rates are. And so there's different ways to do it. You could just do a regression, which is penalized, or sparse regression. We can do convex optimization. And what you find is that you can take these very complicated interaction networks and even with noise in your signal, reconstruct with dynamic range the original interaction strengths. And this is simply an adaptation of what Stein et al. Did in PLOS Comp Bio 2013 as applies to mice metagenomes, but now applied to a bipartite network as opposed to a unipartite network. Yep.
How much of this depends on you getting the model right?
So there's a big model specification.
Yeah, like
model.
If you feel like, And like, for example, these linear models are only going to be, maybe reasonable near like a fixed point or something.
So no, you don't want them to be near a fixed point. So they are strong when you're not. So there's two questions I think you're asking. One is about the structural stability. They're both good questions. Structural stability and where you need to be in space, in terms of the state space. If you're closer to the fixed point, it's actually worse for you because you have less, let's say, fluctuations to learn from. But the bigger problem, so if you're out of equilibrium, that's actually better for you. And we've quantified that. So we start the model closer and closer to equilibrium. We find that we do better predictions farther away to a certain point.
But we don't have a model for actual biology, right? your like linearized model is going to fail. Like, it's only going to be useful if things are, you know, maybe like pretty similar, such that the linearization makes sense.
So the linearization makes sense if we sample differently than how people have done before. So that's one. There's still the model specification. Is this structurally stable? And I don't have a good answer to that. I mean, there's problems there. If we sample, we don't want to sample every month, because if we're not getting something which is reasonable per capita changes, so if we wait a month to sample, this model makes no sense. You can't do it. So what we're working on with experimental is actually to do the sampling on hourly timescale, in which you have relatively smooth changes in strain level densities, and we can observe that. There's evidence of that going to be coming out.
But then if you do that sampling per hour on, like, yeah, you know, one day, and you go come back 6 months later, are you going to get the same?
We're not going to do. I mean, we're trying to learn from short, multi-day experiments that are high resolution rather than co-occurrence data sets over longer time scales. I don't know what to do with the co-occurrence data.
Just because it's like, you know, like, you might find you get some interaction matrix out, but like, you know, if the underlying dynamics is not some linear dynamics, but some, you know, complicated dynamics, that interaction matrix that you measure might be different, you know, today versus, like,
yeah, so keep in mind that this is a linearization of a nonlinear dynamics, right? So that we're trying, but there could be other nonlinear dynamics, but it's true that we are going to try, we have to make some approximations to do it. In practice, it's worked as a predictive model. I mean, everything you said, that same critique could have applied to what Stein et al. Did. It worked. I think it's worth trying given the failure of the correlation method, but your critiques are fair. Yep.
You said it works if you add kind of noise in the measurement process. Does it work if you add kind of biological noise between, or only the deterministic model?
Right, so you're saying if we made the model inherently stochastic.
Yeah.
Right, so at the densities that we're dealing with, we aren't getting information about rare interactions, at which point then your stochasticity would be more important. I don't have a full answer to that, but for the most part, we're learning about those things that are relatively common so that we can observe them frequently enough, in which case, there's not so much of a difference between the two model outcomes. Yeah. There already is. There's another form of stochasticity here, which is the variability in life history traits, and that we are accounting for. Right. But we're not accounting for that alone.
Do you need to include in your model also some environmental variables? Like, I don't know, light, availability, if you are sampling every hour?
Yeah, so there is another component, which is to change some of these core models and actually have Dyeel-driven stuff, because you can go also on BioArchive, just came out a few days ago, there are Dyeel cycles of the bacteria, so these aren't fixed traits, so we know about that. There's also, whether they're actual or induced, Dyeel cycles of phage. So these cyanophage also have a Dyeel component, but this may be induced because they're infecting things that themselves reveal, or they have their own way of dealing with light. So yeah, we are hoping to expand some of this, because if we're looking at daily cycles in marine environments, then the Dyeel cycle most of all is the important one. Yeah. I don't have a full answer yet. We're still doing the experiments. So I'm just putting this out there as a concept that I think is worth testing, given, in my view, the failure of the sort of standard correlation-based approach, even in theory, to work. And I'd argue that these model-based approach, given successes in mouse guts, are worth trying within virus microbes, but maybe the next time I'll show you what the data says. But we are in the midst of both doing and designing those experiments. Some of them have been done, but we may have to redo some of them. So that's, again, the take-homes, that using model-based, and also gives you a test of the model. If the model fails and you don't infer the right networks, that's telling you something about the failure of the model, maybe something new about the interactions.
So this is simulation data.
These are simulation data.
You haven't tried to build a model-inspired inference.
So we have asked for money to do all of this, and it's not been funded yet. But we have gotten other sequence data that looks like it's going to be good enough for us to begin to try it. So we're in the midst of doing it, but I don't have the results yet. Okay, so that's a little bit of what I think we know and what we can learn, and I'll now try to, the second part's a little shorter, and so let's see how we do. And I'll begin again by this notion of space, going back to the fact that this was this one observation, but just one observation, and I've claimed that it's held up over time. We decided to go back with this working group to take a look at the last 25 to 30 years worth of data collection of virus microbe abundances in marine environments and ask, how true is it that there is this particular level or density of viruses in natural environments? And is there any particular ratio between viruses and microbes? You probably have heard of this notion that there's 10 to 1. And so that was sort of this canonical idea that was out there, and is that hold up to be true? So this is from about 22 different samples taken both from the surface and at depth in marine environments. And the thing I want to show here, these are prokaryotes, you can think of as microbes, here that span from about tens of thousands to millions or above, or even tens of millions per milliliter. And likewise, these are the viruses from up to almost 100 million or more per milliliter. This is the 1-to-1 line, the 10-to-1 line, and there are contours here of the data, with the green denoting that from the surface and the blue from deeper ocean. So the first thing that we wanted to investigate was the extent to which it was appropriate to say there's 10-to-1 viruses per microbes, because when you say that, the tendency within the biological field was to think, well, if I say 10, it means 8 is typical, but 2 is not, and 50 is certainly not. That's an exception. And so here are the 95% distributions between 2.5 and 160, meaning it's typical to find variation from just a few to hundreds or more viruses per microbe. And I think that's an important message to take away, that it's not as if it's always this number that's an emergent feature of all ocean ecosystems. It's not the case. And similar at depth, it goes from about 4 to 75. Large variations are typical. The other thing about 10-to-1 is that one can use it as a predictive model to think about other effects. And so what we then tried to look was at each individual survey differently. So these are different surveys taken in different oceanographic regimes. We've also tried to reorganize them by the oceanographic regimes, by Longhurst provinces, if any oceanographers are in the audience. That tends to be a bad idea for various reasons. So you'll notice here that the blue line is the best fit power law here on log transform data. The gray line is 10-to-1. And the orange line is the overall best fit power law if I lumped all the data together. And what you notice is that there are groups that are just sitting off. They're just offset. And also the slopes vary. It's not as if there's this necessarily all a central tendency, and certainly this notion of this 10-to-1 seems to be a bad idea. So what we found is, in fact, that these, if we try to fit these power law relationships, and again, in terms of predictive ability, it's better, though it raises a different set of questions. This is the slope of the power law with distributions, and in general, these slopes sit below 1, right? Which says that it's not as if we've gotten the ratio wrong, and it should be 5 or 20. But actually, as we increase microbes, yes, there are more viruses, but the ratio of viruses to microbes is going down. And so those two things, I mean, this is sort of evident to physicists. It's not complicated. But it's something that, within the biology community, was not well appreciated. So again, more viruses because we have this parallel relationship, but it's sublinear, so the virus-to-microbe ratio decreases with increasing microbial abundance rather than remaining fixed.
How do you fit these things?
Sorry.
Yeah, standard OLS for various reasons having to do with error. We can think of type 2 regression. There's a reason, given what we expect errors, that type 2 is not appropriate. We check that too. So it's standard OLS regression on log transform data. So the other interesting thing here, and this is going to get into the challenges, and I have about 5-10 minutes left here of what I wanted to say, is that we've assumed in these overall fits that there's this power law and there's some spread and the predictability of this is terrible, and I'm not trying to claim, in fact what I'm trying to say here is that this fitting one power law is not a good idea, that there are different regimes and there are just different rules in different places. There's just not one rule. What's interesting, though, is that we've tried out a different model, which is usually when you do these fits, you assume constant variance. But you can also make the variance increase or be a function of microbes. And we found that that was actually a better fit. You can kind of see that it spreads out, which suggests that surface environments tend to be more different than each other than our environments at depth, which is another take-home there. So really the challenge is, in my view, is looking at site-specific heterogeneity, that these locations, these different transects, different sample locations, are not all following the same one law with this 10-to-1 rule, nor are they following the same nonlinear slope, meaning that different regimes seem to have different types of relationships. So fewer viruses per microbes as microbes increase, and the profiles in the surface are dissimilar, and even the sites are different than the other. So what can we learn? And this came out last year. And I think that there's already been a lot of debate, not just within our group, but within the community, about what are the potential covariates? What's driving the fact that different environments tend to have different kinds of relationships between how many viruses there are and how many microbes there are. There are all sorts of candidates, including nutrients, most prominently, specifically whether it's nitrate or phosphate or so on, that may be driving different top-down or bottom-up control. And I won't go into that. What I wanted to go into in detail is this notion that maybe the model, and I'll go back to your question, maybe the model is wrong. That really what's going on here is that lysogeny is more important than we thought, rather than a lytically driven interaction between viruses and hosts. And so this is a paper that came out, and Sued Forrest Rauer's in here, as we've had some debates about this. This is led by Forrest. It's a notion of piggyback the winner. So I want to explain what that idea is, raise some questions about it, and then it's an intro for ours going forward, but I'm happy to discuss the evidence there as well. Okay, so what is the piggyback the winner idea? So the idea is that as one increases from low to high microbial density, there should be a shift in activity of viruses that tend to interact in a lytic mode, an antagonistic mode, get in and kill their host, to ones in which they increasingly enter lysogeny and integrate with their host. And the claim is that as the environment gets more productive or more dense with microbes, that lysogeny increases. This is the idea of piggyback, so you're sort of there with the abundant type. I'm not saying this is my idea, I'm saying this is the claim of the paper. And the opposite thing should happen, that there should be less lysis at high densities and higher lysis when there's low densities. And the reason why this has become controversial is that the data and some of the early work by Bruce Levin, I don't know if he talked about why be temperate. Did he talk about that last week? He probably told you the opposite, that lysogeny is a strategy to deal with low density situations. And the data, to the extent that it's available in marine environments, this is called work by Jennifer Broom, is now at LSU, on seasonal time bombs in the Southern Ocean, which is, the polar oceans, not Southern Ocean, polar ocean near the Arctic, that you look at the fraction of bacteria that seem to have integrated viruses. And there are ways to do such things by inducing them. And they find that here in the spring, winter and spring months, that there is a high number of bacteria that seem to be infected, right, when things are not very productive for the bacteria. But when summer comes, then all of a sudden you can't find any lysogens. I mean, you can't find viruses that are integrated with their host. And instead, you find lots more evidence of infected bacteria that are on their way to lysis. Right? So there seems to be a shift that's precisely the opposite of this, which is why it's a controversial idea, right? Because it's in contradiction to some of this marine evidence and also some older theory. So I'm going to unpack it a little bit, and obviously you're going to see that I'm skeptical, but I have found it interesting to rethink some of my preconceptions about how important lysogeny is, and it's something that I hope to say more about in the future. So the first claim is really statistical. What they did is they went to a coral reef environment and measured lysogeny proxies within metagenomes, viral metagenomes outside cells. So there are ways that you can look for evidence that something might be potentially lysogenic, looking at integrases, oxygenases, other things associated with lysogeny. But they're not looking inside cells, they're looking outside cells. So here's an example from these coral reefs. Log 10 microbial cells, percent provirus-like reads. And there are ways to ignore these two points. But if you don't ignore those two points, or even if you do, we did not find the same degree of strength between this driver and this apparent increase in this percent provirus-like reads. So even if this were true, and we find evidence that it's not, meaning we don't find the same statistical evidence as they do, that there is this positive increase between provirus-like reads outside cells and increasing microbial loads. Even if it were, the reason why we got into this is, what would that say? These are outside the cells. So if you see things outside the cells that have provirus-like reads, that suggests, yes, they are temperate phage, perhaps, but they're outside the cell, which means they've induced, which means they've lysed. And that would actually suggest that more lysis is happening, because you're looking outside, not inside the cells. So that's one point. The other point is that, which got us interested in the first place, is we began to think, well, what is the appropriate model to write to describe virus-microbe interactions if you want to think about lysogeny? And so this is the model that was proposed of this piggyback the winner. You have microbial cells, you have viruses. You notice there's not a lysogen class. There's not an infected cell class, which suggests some difficulty in actually thinking about what lysogeny is going to do. Instead, you have microbial growth, you have lysis mortality, viral decay. So it's all standard, everything that I've already shown you in these Lockhart-Volterra-like models. The only difference is that now viral release has a N over K dependence. It's the only difference between the standard Lockhart-Volterra model. And that suggests that actually, as you increase density, you get more lysis. You get greater burst sizes because the lysis hasn't changed at all. You just get greater burst sizes, which again suggests the wrong mechanism. The thing that this does, though, is yield these decreasing patterns of VMR with microbial abundance increases. So it has that consequence, but the mechanism is one in which it seems to suggest that burst sizes get bigger as you increase density, which is the opposite, again, to the underlying approach. And the other claim is that other models can't do this. So this is microbial density, VMR. These are log with contours and lines and power laws of best fit, which are not very good fits, but that's the same as applies to our data. These are from simulation where you take these models, vary life history traits because we have uncertainty, and see the consequence. And what we find is that whether it's the piggyback the winner, the standard Lockhart-Volterra model, or other variants, that there tends to be this decrease. So using this evidence of VMR decreasing is just too low a bar in our opinion. You can get other models with totally different mechanisms to yield that same pattern. So it's really here an issue that we have of conflating the mechanism with the pattern and what is sufficient to say that one mechanism is operating. And so I'll just close with this thought, which is, and this is the part where I think this Knowles et al. Paper is going to have a long-term benefit, even though we disagree with some of the individual conclusions, which is there has been a tendency to focus on lytic interactions, environments, and also thinking of them in this well-mixed case. This is some modeling work we've done where you can have spatial structure and change the multiplicity of infection because you have co-occurring infections. When you have different multiplicities, that tends to also favor different outcomes. This, we only let the viruses have this lytic outcome, but there's old work by Kurilsky showing that tends, if the virus could be temperate, this would be the conditions in which it might engage in a lysogenic lifestyle. So our point that I'm interested in moving forward is both thinking about these spatial dynamics unfolding whether on particles or in local domains, and also thinking a little bit more about the ways in which lysogeny can be advantageous, not in a group selection sense, but actually advantageous to that viral genome in trying to propagate. And again, maybe that's something we can talk about whether later today or in the future. So with that, I just want to wrap up and again point out some of the papers on structure with been published usually a few years ago, but there's some recent stuff on these coexistence models and inference, largely as part of Luis Jover's thesis, and we have ongoing work. And everything I talked about at the end, it's going to be coming out soon in a publication, but for the moment, you can find an early draft of this sort of critique of the piggyback the winner model and some of our data analysis on the bioarchive. But again, that'll be coming out hopefully in the next month or so. And that's it. Happy to take questions. Thanks.
So I have a basic question that I like. So you're describing the interaction and equilibrium of phages and microbes on this very, very large scale. If I understand correctly, normally a phage has phages have sort of very large growth. 100, 1,000, there's some number, which is large, right?
It's very
even though the number of phages is very large, still they're surely not growing exponentially with this gigantic exponent. So presumably most of the phages that are produced by any single lytic effect are kaput.
Yeah, so
then. So therefore, this propagation from, one lysis to the next is some sort of very narrow and stochastic bottleneck. Yet in this continuum model, so we just assume that the number of infections is proportional to the number of bacteria. But perhaps it depends very much on how these bacteria are clumped. right? So if that's the case, then I sort of have to say, okay, so what's the number, how does the number of clumps scale the number of bacteria? It will be quadratic, right? And this is just some random idea, right? So is this even vaguely a correct representation of what's going on in terms of this Lotka-Volterra type thing?
Let me try to unpack the first part. And honestly, the fact that we're building these spatial models, both for our phage therapeutic model and these, suggests that we are also thinking along these lines and agree with some of what you just said. But even the first part, it's very important not to think of viral fitness in terms of burst size. That is not viral fitness, and I hope I didn't say it. So as I explained, so in the book I try to do this, you should think in terms of a basic reproduction number. And so if you have 100 viruses that come out at steady state, only one of those 100 viruses can make it. The other 99 must go. I mean, maybe sometimes two make it and it increases, and sometimes a half make it and it goes down. So if you think about a reproduction number, you have to complete the cycle. And so you have the number of viruses, right, times the probability that they find a new host before they go kaput. Right? And that tells you, because they're going to initiate the next stage, that becomes what is called a basic or effective reproduction number. And that number can be much smaller. It has to be much smaller than beta, because there's many ways for them to aggregate. They can hit the wrong host. They can decay by UV light. So it's absolutely essential. And it also depends on density. So it doesn't, even in those, when you do an invasion argument, the deterministic model tells you the thing, but it doesn't say that probabilistically, as a function of this reproduction number, what it should be. It just says if it's above one, it'll invade. And we know that's wrong. But it still gives you the right number, whether you think about it in the OD model or in the stochastic model. So I'm going to try to just agree with that first part. You should not think about burst size as fitness. It's about completing a life cycle. And we're expanding that to other parts. I think that perspective is important. It's been lost. In that spatial model I showed, the consequence of having clustering in space is that you're often hitting the same host, and you don't, as I said before, get extra killing. And so we found that when you build these spatial models, instead of getting an exponential distribution of multiplicity infection, you get a power law tail or a long tail, and that long tail has very different consequences. And that we didn't build in, it's just sort of a nature of the fact that you have co-occurrence between where you burst and the next host, which is likely to be close to the host you just found. And we don't know all the consequences, but I agree that then you have a local reproduction number, which varies depending on local density of hosts. And that may not be homogeneous everywhere.
Yeah. Josh, that I think I'm asking a similar question as Boris. Yeah. This is what you're touching on. Can you rephrase this a bit for me in terms of metapopulation theory? Because that's kind of, to me, intuitively what you just said. I would think microbes are going to be locally successful sometimes, and other times it's going to be crap, and they can't necessarily control where they are. So is that unnecessary for me to invoke that you rephrase this for me and help me?
So there's two parts to it, I think, because there's two different scales. Even within one population, I mean, I think for those of you who study epidemics, if you think about susceptible individuals and you ask what is the basic reproduction number, and then you could ask an effective reproduction number if there are some hosts that are not accessible to you. So from the basic group, even within one population, so you add this new virus into, you found the good pool in your metapopulation, you've arrived. Will you spread even locally in order for you to disperse to the next one? And what I've just described there is an argument to say that the ability of the virus to spread even locally depends not on the burst size, but also on the burst size and its how hostile the environment is when it's outside the cell. The density of those hosts, how often it contacts, and that together tells me fitness locally. Now, to get to that next population has to, whether it be dispersal or investment, you might say, in not dying, so that even if you're good locally, you may not be so good, because you may be good at when there's high end, but if the density becomes low and you die quickly, that makes you bad at getting to the next place. And so I think we've also, by thinking about reproduction in terms of not just the burst size, but also not dying when you're not inside the host, which is part of the life cycle, that starts to explain why that is a evolutionary successful approach, because it could get you to the next patch, which allows you to spread. So I think
I totally agree. I mean, it's sort of reminding me, but if you go and look at hot springs that have low pH, you never find, as far as I can tell, lytic viruses, because the outside realm is just too hostile.
Yeah, I mean, we work with Mark Young and Rachel Whitaker on these extreme hotspots, and we find a lot of alternative modes of viral infection. But part of that is also there's competition amongst the viruses for their hosts. So some of them seem to have different approaches, nicer approaches to their hosts to get rid. There are lytic viruses, but they seem to sometimes be eliminated by the nicer viruses who collaborate with their hosts in certain ways and have defenses against the infection. So I'm not sure it's
like a net.
That's right. Yeah.
It's a selection for mutualism because that's
there. That's what we're. Yeah.
If you look at your metrics and you mix them with your biogeography data, do you see any patterns like, I don't know, viruses that infect very few bacteria, they're found only locally versus, so patterns of cosmopolitanism and endemism, is that anyhow related?
We didn't have enough, we had tried to go through some of the taxonomic basis. I mean, in some of these individual studies, we don't have enough to do a biogeographical claim. In the big MOVIS study, we were able to show that these modules are comprised. There is a geographic signal. I mean, it's not everything is mixed in, but the spatial extent is big, right? So hundreds of kilometers, you could find something in the same module. So there definitely seems to be a notion that it doesn't have to be at one location, but it's not as if it's the modules are, the Atlantic Ocean is totally well mixed with respect to infectivity. So there was a biogeographic signal, but I've seen stronger signals in hot springs and other places with less mixing. They seem to have stronger signals.
Sorry, just follow up. Wouldn't you expect that viruses that only infect a few hosts, a stronger biogeographical signal?
I mean, I see what you're getting in the marine environment because some of these hosts are so ubiquitous that if you found a cosmopolitan host, then...
Yeah, that's why I was wondering whether there are pairing.
I don't have any evidence either way. Yeah. All right, thanks.